hell, you're going to abort the mission. We owe her better than that.
Oh, you don't owe her shit!
Will you keep your voice down?
You don't owe her shit.
May I say one thing?
Speak.
Y'all beat the hell out of that woman, but you didn't kill her. And I put a bullet in her head, but her heart just kept on beating. Now, you saw that yourself with your own beautiful blue eye, did you not? We've done a lot of things to this lady. And if she ever wakes up, we'll do a whole lot more. But one thing we won't do is sneak into her room in the night like a filthy rat and kill her in her sleep.
Welcome to part two of our Kill Bill Volume 1 episode. That's a lot of numbers, Alex. But before we go into real talk, it's time for PP, our patron pitch. This is where we let our patrons know what they can expect in their exclusive patron feed, and we let non-patrons know what they're missing out on. So the month of March, the month of our 200th episode, the big celebration is right here on the main feed, right? Volume 1 mm-hmm. for Kill Bill, Volume 2 for Kill Bill, but there's other stuff going on the patron feed. All patrons, starting with the Travolta tier, you're going to get the Cutting Room Floor segment. Anything that Chaz said that didn't make it to the main feed to this episode, that's going to be there. The last few times that we recorded with Chaz, we didn't have a patron. So anything that didn't make it to the final cut is lost to the sands of time. But that's not going to be the case here. And anybody can access it. Just like you can also access this month's bonus episode. Every month we cover at least one extra movie. And this month is the movie Om Shanti Om, an Indian movie that surprisingly is not demanded by patron Brandon Curtis, who usually gives us Indian movies. Instead, it's demanded by patron Ryan from Spit and Polish and the Yum Yum podcast. I don't know why, Alex.
I don't either. But here we are.
Another curveball. So, Om Shanti Om, available to everybody. Also available to everybody, the chat. Download the Patreon app. As long as you're a patron, you have access to it, and you can see me posting updates on the editing. You can see other patrons just commenting on what we just released. It's a lot of fun. Now, if you want more, you can just kick it up to the Winotis tier, the $3 tier, and then you get access to our pre-recording notes. You get access to our quick video reviews. This month, Alex, we have demands from patron Stu from the Sewer Order, and you are getting a movie called What Keeps You Alive, and I'm getting a movie called Deep Murder. I have no idea what this is. I don't know.
What Keeps You Alive is anything after 2014, I consider recent. So it is a recent movie from 2018, premiered at South By. It is a Canadian psychological horror film. 98 minutes, so let's fucking go.
Right up your alley. Horror, almost 90 minutes, South By Southwest. That just says Alex.
Well, that last part, no, but.
Oh, God. I just pulled up Deep Murder, and the poster or the screenshot, it's Jerry O'Connell sticking his tongue out. This doesn't bode well.
Let's go.
2019. An hour and 35 minutes, comedy horror. All right. All right, Stu. We'll see what we got. About 90-minute picks. That's the way to go. That's how you do it. And then you also get Contrarians After Hours. That's the spin-off show where we tell you about other things that we're watching, that we're listening to, that we're thinking about, that we're playing. Alex, what are you bringing to Contrarians After Hours this time?
Well, Julio, time-hopping a bit for our patrons next month. You have to look forward to a Dancer in the Dark episode, a collab with us and the boys from the Film Busters. We recorded that in real time yesterday, which would have been March 3rd of 2024. I start off the episode by addressing that in the world of professional wrestling, it was the day of Sting's last match. Not the musician, not the guy from the Police, but
he's still
Steve
going.
Borden. Yes, Steve Borden, the professional wrestler that portrayed the character Sting for almost 40 years. And last night was his last match. And you know, he was a guy that had a very interesting run and was someone who was very influential and very important to a lot of people. Myself personally, I saw him wrestle live in four different decades. I saw him in 99, in 2006, in 2015, and then in 2022. So that's pretty insane, you know, because I'm not as old as Julio. So you have to think about like when that started. I was a little kid, but he was described repeatedly in this run up to his final match as wrestling's last superhero. And I'll explain kind of what that means and who he was as a wrestler, what he brought to the table. And I feel it's fair because he is in Contrarian's lore. He was in a movie we covered once. So I feel I need to give him the proper send off and just explain who he was and why he was kind of one of a kind. Not in the way of like Terry Funk or some other wrestlers I've talked about before in our on our patron, I should say, but someone who The Rock was captivated by, someone who John Cena in his youth was very inspired by, it, even from just, you know, a performance perspective and a bodybuilding perspective, because that's like most wrestlers of the day in the 80s. Steve Borden started as a bodybuilder that someone was just like, hey, put this face paint on and go out there and yell and see what happens. But very interesting career, very unique career. The ground covered both from him professionally and me with like my fandom of him. I don't know if you saw Julio, but I posted a picture yesterday before the show of me as I couldn't have been older than six.
Oh, I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a wrestling buddy of Sting that I was playing with. And so, yeah, that's going to be my contribution to After Hours. He has a few acting credits to speak to, so I still want to keep it in the realm of what we do. So I'll be sure to circle that in as well. But stories, anecdotes abound, and just a recap of the great career of Sting. Julio, how about yourself? What are you bringing to the table?
One of the things I will cover on my After Hours side is the documentary Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, which I watched almost by accident. Have you seen it, Alex?
No, I've kind of stayed away from it by choice because I've heard like at parts it's kind of skin crawling, especially like we've covered this before. Metallica was much, much bigger to me in my youth than it was to you. So I've kind of avoided it by choice.
It's, I think that now that you've seen them live, I think that you just have to complete the journey now.
Yeah, that's fair.
You've seen them at their most mythical, and now I think you need to see them at their most human, because it sounds almost like a bad joke. Like, oh, let's make a documentary about this hardcore metal band going to therapy to talk about their feelings. But that's exactly what it is, and it's fascinating. I caught that on Netflix. And then also on Netflix, it's the movie Naiad, I think that's how you pronounce it, scored two nominations, I think, for the Oscars this year. Best Supporting Actress for Jodie Foster, Best Leading Actress for Annette Bening. I don't know that I would have watched it if it wasn't an Oscar nominee, but you know me, around this time of the year, I just try to watch as many of them as I can. So it was under 2 hours. I like Annette Bening. I like Jodie Foster. So I figured I'd give it a shot. And I guess it did make me realize that I had forgotten how fun Jodie Foster can be as an actress. I think that because mostly now I think of her as a director, and also whenever I see her on screen, it's serious roles, but she's having a lot of fun in
Naiad. When like Taxi Driver and Silence of the Lambs are like your most memorable roles, exactly. It's easy to forget that someone can have a good time.
She was in Maverick, and she was a delight in Maverick. And she's a delight.
She
in
was
movie.
Nell in the movie Nell.
Yes, she was. Anyway, Naiad, Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, and then a tribute to Sting, not the musician, but the wrestler. That's your After Hours. And then if you want to be part of those patrons that tell us what to do, that's what the $5 tier and the $10 tier, that's what they're for, the Embrys and the Gads. So go to patreon.com/contrarianprime, look at what we're offering, and see how you would like to join the Contrarian Supplements.
$1, $3, $5, and $10 are respective tiers. We have our goals out there right now for 30, 40, and 50 patrons when we cross those thresholds. Some big undertakings out there that we look forward to getting to eventually, but that's not to look past our current patrons and the love and admiration we hold dearly for you. So thank you to all of those who have pledged their patronage. And for those of you who are on the fence, it's a dollar. Part with it. I went to Taco Bell today. There's not anything you can get for a dollar there anymore. We have fallen as a country. And if we're going to live in this dystopia, you can at least just take four quarters and give it to me and Julio just so you can hear extended conversations about God knows what. Because we also just dropped some new cutting room floor material from our Neon Demon episode, which is a lot of Ryan just accosting me for what he perceives me, my bad tastes in film and just pop culture in general. So that is our sales pitch. That is what our patrons can expect coming up for them. Julio, I know it's on the other side of the goddamn planet, but I think Chaz is ready to take the red eye and come back into the studio.
All right, let's go to real talk.
Welcome to Arrow. May I help you?
Okinawa. One way.
All right, here's Chaz coming back into the studio, ready to to express his true feelings about Kill Bill Volume 1. Join Alex, join me in really revealing how we feel about this movie. And before we get into it, I waded through the sea of fresh tomatoes, and there's several green splotches. So I'm going to hit you guys with those. We're going to start with Jeffrey Westhoff from Northwest Herald, Crystal Lake, Illinois, who says, just as only NBA fanatics can justify watching the first three quarters of a game, only Tarantino fanatics will be satisfied with the first installment of Kill Bill.
The fuck is that stray throughout the NBA? Basketball games fly by, dude. Like, that's a very strange critique to make. That'd be way better suited saying something about baseball.
Even to somebody who's not into sports, I can see how that would be more appropriate. Chaz, what's the Australian equivalent of a really slow sport that picks up at the very end?
Cricket, of which I'm an avid fan. Like, cricket matches literally go for 5 days, and we just had one of the most exciting cricket matches end on Sunday, where the West Indies, in an undermanned team, beat Australia when we had 9 runs to win. Anyone who knows what I'm talking about, that was hugely exciting.
But was it just defined by the last, I don't know,
two hours? Like, the first 4 days, like, who gives a shit? But the last 2 hours, like, oh my God, this is amazing. I live for this.
You can make the argument with basketball that sometimes, especially in more high profile games, the actual action in the closing quarter is more boring because guys are just trying to eat the clock up. It's not like when they start the game and they're just going for hell for leather to see who can score more. So to the reviewer that made that review, I award you no points and may God have mercy on your soul.
I mean, also just completely untrue about this film, where, like, arguably the first half was interesting and then the rest of it was completely dull.
I mean, he says first three quarters. This guy was really, you know, give me 90 minutes of nothing. And then I guess he really likes it, the fight with Lucy Liu. That's where it picks up. All right. Jamie Bernard from New York Daily News says, there's a lot to admire in Kill Bill and a lot that should have been lopped off, like the arms and legs and scalps that go flying. I did not remember that it was under 2 hours.
It's a definite positive.
Yes. Alex, would you have cut it to even under 90 minutes?
I mean, I guess I'll just go ahead and play my hand. It's this. I don't know if I went through this and cut out things that I found unnecessary or redundant. Yes, I could get this movie shortened down, but that's not what this movie wants to be. It may just be something that we have to come to the agree to disagree. Me and old Quentin on this one.
I can just imagine Quentin Tarantino's reaction as you come up to him and was like, hey man, can I edit Kill Bill Volume 1? I promise you, it'll be better.
The maddest
cut. I was going to bring it up in Concerns Corner, in the first part of the episode, and I completely forgot, Chaz. You have had a much closer interaction with Quentin Tarantino than either
about
of us.
This film. I was going to bring it up in Contrarian's Corner as a way of, like, bragging, you know, like, oh, me and Quentin have discussed this in person. But it's somewhat asynchronous conversation but it does go to, like, I feel like Tarantino's ego is that on my podcast, which is extremely niche, right? It's Draft Zero. We read screenplays and break them down from a craft side of things. And we did an episode dedicated just to Tarantino's writing, not to his directing, where we were breaking down his scripts. And we looked at Kill Bill and we had a mild critique around how his screenwriting was only for himself. Like, he couldn't, I mean, as a person who's written for TV and sold scripts, like, he can clearly do that. But the script of Kill Bill, we harped on one particular line, and Tarantino must have fucking listened to that episode,
because oh,
then
amazing.
He criticized us on his podcast with Brett Easton Ellis. He's like, oh, these guys from Australia, they just don't understand. Like, oh my God. And, you know, it was like both one of the most thrilling moments of my life. I'm like, oh my God, Tarantino listened to my podcast. But then also where he's just like shitting on us. And I'm like, oh.
Amazing.
I love it. And I had forgotten that the movie that made this happen was Kill Bill. Because if I had...
Yeah, I thought you were making me do this movie just so that I had to relive that very painful memory.
No,
Thank you.
I thought it was... I guess in my mind, it'd been his writing in general. I didn't remember it was specific to Kill Bill. That's even better. Yeah. That's fine. You know what? Hey, both things can be true. What you said about him and also just him saying that he doesn't care.
I mean, I don't want to get in the weeds here, but just to defend myself, it was from a scene that was cut from the movie, right? Like, after she drives out of the hospital in the pussy wagon, she goes to the desert and finds a rock under which is buried some money and some passports and things to explain how she can just like swan around the world. But in the end, it's unnecessary to the story and he cut it. But in the script, it's like she picks up the rock and if there is no X underneath this rock, then it will have all been for nothing. And she will just stop this massive quest of revenge. And it's like, well, none of that is performative. She's just going to pick up a rock and see there's an X under it. No one's going to know that. Anyway, just some screenwriting trivia for you that Tarantino deeply disagrees with.
He didn't say anything about our Pulp Fiction episode. So you know what? Take it as a win.
Well, I think you guys need to take that as a win, because they would listen to that and go, these contrarians don't know what they're talking about.
I would wear it. It's a badge of pride. All right. I wonder how he would react to this. Mick LaSalle from San Francisco Chronicle says, it boggles the mind that after 6 years of silence, all Tarantino has to offer is this garbage.
Garbage, jeez.
That seems extreme. I mean, that is one of those words that I think it particularly sounds extra harsh to me. Like, whenever somebody says that something is garbage or it's trash, I know that there's worse things that you can call a movie or you can call anything, but I don't know why garbage just feels like so demeaning. I don't think Kill Bill Volume 1 is garbage. just putting it out there. And we are going to close with Steve Schneider from Orlando Weekly, who says, for the first time, Tarantino has made a film that validates almost every charge his detractors have leveled against him. That's a good starting point, I think, because I can maybe...
I can get behind that one a little more.
Yeah, I mean, what were the criticisms before Kill Bill, from people that didn't like Reservoir Dogs, didn't like Pulp Fiction, somehow didn't like Jackie Brown, and how you can go and say, see, Kill Bill proves him right. Is it just that there's no morality in his storytelling, that, you know, that it's just all about the cool shots and the narrative tricks, but there's no like moral center? Maybe I can't imagine anybody saying that about Jackie Brown.
I find morality in Jackie Brown, but also the punchline of that's the only movie he didn't write that he directed.
You didn't think it was going to be that easy, did you? You know, for a second there. Yeah, I kind of did.
So I don't know. I mean, if what you are accusing him of is that he doubles down on the violence almost unnecessarily, then Kill Bill is just, well, you could argue that's all there is.
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to go to a Tarantino film not expecting ultra violence? And look, I was one of the people at the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood just absolutely dying of laughter as Leonardo DiCaprio brings out the flamethrower to torch that Manson family member. I was like, yes. And where, you know, Brad Pitt's like bouncing that other poor woman's face off the wall. Like, it's ultra violent, but it, like, he's not trying to be realistic in his violence. And Kill Bill is certainly doing that as well. Like, the geysers of blood are hilarious and over the top and, you know, so deliberate.
Why are your movies so violent? Because it's so much fun, Jan.
Yes.
If you didn't think that Tarantino's previous three movies were fun in that sense, then you had no business going to watch Kill Bill Volume 1. It's a movie that told you exactly what it was going to be about from the first trailer, from the teaser trailer. Maybe not to an extent. I don't know if you guys remember what it was like. Because, yeah, we make fun of it now. And I think, in a way, justifiably so. You know, that to sell the movie as like the fourth film from Quentin Tarantino. And but it was a big deal, right? Like, we hadn't seen anything from him since Jackie Brown. And then this comes up and it's like, the name is just so straightforward, like Kill Bill.
I was going to say in Contrarian's Corner, it's like, how long do you think it took him to come up with the title?
I mean, like, the whole fourth film from Quentin Tarantino thing, and obviously it's only gotten bigger each time when you look at his filmography, but like, he's one of the only directors really left that, you know, to a lesser extent, Marty and a few other folks, but like, his movies are event movies just because of who he is, you know, and he's made less than 10 movies.
So Chaz, how was it over there? I mean, I imagine it was the same as here, but because you got it at the same time, right? It was such a big deal movie.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I mean, look, I was a young movie aficionado at the time. So I went running to this film, and I remember also going running to the Grindhouse Double Bill and being much more disappointed than with Kill Bill.
Oh,
but it did feel, it's interesting looking at it in his filmography, because like, I'm going to lay my real talk cards on the table, and I'm going to be interested to rewatch Volume 2 and see how I feel. But just Volume 1, I remember going to it and feeling disappointed after Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, where, yes, his attitude towards violence and he was super stylized, but this was all style and deliberately no substance, right? And then after that, you've got Death Proof and Grindhouse, and I'm just like, oh, is Tarantino gone? Has he disappeared up his own ass? but I think he managed with, like, this is, to your point, Alex, this is clearly exactly the film he wanted to make. Like, it's just unapologetically, like, everything's super deliberate, and he does clearly love the movies that he's paying homage to. And while I'm unsure whether a white dude can make a film like Kill Bill today, there's clearly nothing but love from him as to what he's trying to do, but it's all about just going along for the ride and enjoying it and not trying to be clever for even a second, which is unlike him in all of his other films, because I feel like Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like, he's been let off the leash to do whatever the hell he wants by Kill Bill, but then at least he's got something to say with those movies. Whereas I don't think, at least Kill Bill Volume 1 does not seem to have anything to say whatsoever other than come and have fun with me while we fuck some shit up.
Remember Jackie Brown and how you didn't like it? Okay. Thank you for allowing me to do that. I'm going to do something that's more up to your liking. On the cultural appropriation thing, I just thought about this because, you know, honestly, it never occurred to me. And then you brought it up in the Stress Corner. And I was like, yes, of course. In the sense that you can point it out.
I was just trying to be a contrarian. I was...
What I was saying is, like, I don't feel it. I can see how it's a point that some people could try to make. But I think that because it doesn't try to say anything, then, you know, you're not really making a commentary about this culture. You just clearly, this Alex loves the expression love letter. And it's like, yeah, you're just, this is just your love letter to this type of movie, to these genre conventions. And yeah, nobody's expecting, nobody thinks that you're trying to capture the real experience of living in Asia. No, it's just, you know, Uma Thurman finds herself in a kung fu movie, and that's what happens.
I do think the the white person does martial arts better than anyone else trope is like wearing a little thing. I don't know.
I mean, yes, but
we had Iron Fist as part of the Netflix Marvel TV universe and everyone was like, nope.
Yeah. Okay. So would you think if Kill Bill was made today, it wouldn't be Uma Thurman? It would be Lucy Liu.
Yeah.
Playing the bride. I mean, yeah, I can see that.
You also have to entertain the thought that Tarantino really cares about that type of shit.
Why Uma Thurman? Because I want to, Jan.
Because I like her feet.
Yes. My experience watching Kill Bill was the opposite of yours, Chaz. And then I'm curious about yours, Alex, the first time you watched it. Because I went to see it at a midnight screening. We just went to the movies and we were surprised to find out that they had like an 11:30 p.m. show of Kill Bill. And I was like, sure, we'll get it. And I honestly remember thinking that the trailer looked really silly and really corny. And then we sat down and maybe I just had low expectations, but I was blown away. And maybe because I expected him to do something more serious after Jackie Brown, right? Maybe that's why the trailer let me down, because after Jackie Brown, which I liked a lot, it felt like this was just, you know, what is this? But somehow he managed to really capture me. Like I think the energy of it and the, now it doesn't feel as groundbreaking, I guess. But back then I remember thinking, oh, I can't believe that he's doing this. You know, I can't believe that he's just being so, he's having so much fun. Like I think you can tell that he's having so much fun and he's unapologetic about it. And I walked away from it saying, you know, thinking I can't wait to see what happens next. And for me, not going to go too much into it, but the letdown for me was the follow-up, because Volume 2, which I haven't seen also in at least 10 years, is a more serious movie. It kind of like tones down the speed and the pacing. And so I'm really curious to see if I'm going to like it more, you know, when we do it for next episode. But I came out of Volume 1 so pumped and just so convinced that Tarantino could do no wrong, because he had taken us on that zigzag of, you know, Reservoir Dogs to Pulp Fiction to Jackie Brown to Kill Bill. The man is master filmmaker. I will tell you in a minute how I feel about it watching it now. But Alex, do you remember going to the theater to watch the new movie from the guy that did Pulp Fiction and walking out of it? I mean, I guess you were pretty disappointed.
I didn't go to the theater. I rented it when it came out. I can't remember if it would have been on VHS or DVD. VHS was still made till 2005, so it could have been either one. But I rented it and was just thoroughly underwhelmed. I watched it on like HBO or Showtime at some other point again within the past 20 years, kind of as background, because nothing really spoke to me about it. And yes, I know it's supposed to be an homage to, you know, 70s grindhouse exploitation, kung fu, etc., etc. I have a quote, Julio, and I had to go through my Facebook back a few years to find it, because it has always stuck with me and I wanted to make sure I didn't misquote it in a discussion being had on my timeline about Quentin Tarantino's movies. This was after Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out. Of Kill Bill, the one and only John Golson said, because he agreed with me, he said he dislikes The Hateful Eight more, but Kill Bill is at the bottom of his Tarantino rankings. And he said, Kill Bill is like a top 40 pop song by someone who doesn't make pop radio just to show they can if called upon to do so. And that quote has always stuck with me as like the thing I point to. It's like, yes, that's exactly how I feel about it too. It's just Tarantino making this for the sake of making it, which again, I guess you could make the overarching argument that that's why he makes all his movies, but it never did anything for me. It felt too try hard. It still does. And it's not bad, obviously, but it's not for me.
Silly rabbit. Tricks are for kids.
But see, I'll take issue with that quote, or with that comparison, because I think that that description discounts the passion that he seems to have for the material. You know, if you're saying, well, it is somebody who did it just to show that, well, I can make a movie that's just like the movies I like, that seems like almost like he's doing it out of obligation.
Well, I'd argue too that I kind of side with that, because I think like his last three, not Hateful Eight, but Bastards, Django, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, those movies to me feel way more made with like love. Those movies feel like, you know, mom's homemade cookies versus this, which is just kind of like, hey, look at this crazy thing I made in the oven.
Well, I mean, I think that you can be passionate about both things. Only one has, like Chaz was saying, a lot more to say. Like, could you make a kung fu movie? You know, type of movie that Tarantino is kind of paying homage to here, that also has the weight that Django Unchained, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, or Inglourious Basterds, like, that they have. And if it does, would it be as much fun as Kill Bill Volume 1 for those of us who find it fun? I mean, I don't know. Chaz, thoughts?
I think I'm more on the Julio side of things here. Like, Kill Bill is way down my list of Tarantino movies, but that's because most Tarantino movies are pretty incredible, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what makes him incredible is how he doesn't give a shit and how he is just making films for himself and how he's given that leeway. I do think with this film, the credits, he doesn't do credits like that anymore. Like, I think he was in this film really in danger of disappearing up his own. But and look, it's good fun. I loved it. I watched it with the wife last night and she hates violent movies. But at the end of it was like, oh, I can't wait to watch Volume 2 again. Right. So, you know, it's good fun. And all the performances are super heightened. But clearly all the actors are having a great time too, because like, they're all chewing up the scenery, but none of them are delivering bad performances. They know they're in a Tarantino movie and they're living up to it, but they're enjoying it and doing that well.
I think Grindhouse was right after the two Kill Bills, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Grindhouse is where I feel, and you know, at the end it just might, maybe it comes down to, well, I like Kill Bill and I don't like Grindhouse, or, you know, Death Proof, that's his half of it. But that's where I feel like that comparison hits more strongly. Like the idea that with Grindhouse, he was just, it's not perfunctory, but it's just that, oh, well, he's kind of going through the motions of making a Grindhouse movie because that's the joke. The joke is that we're going to have the scratches and the missing frames. Yeah. And, you know, with Kill Bill, maybe I just find it a little more intoxicating because he's just so, like, it's so breakneck speed, like the way that he goes from one thing to the other. And I don't know how much of it was real in Contreras Corner. Alex, do you actually feel that it drags? Do you think that it's boring?
Yeah. But again, it's not we've proven in this discussion that this just isn't for me. And the whole animated sequence, I was just like, oh my God, is anyone else bored? And it's, I don't know. I went into this wanting to like it. I honestly did. And Uma Thurman, to her credit, is much better than I remembered. I remembered everyone kind of being like, blah, like zany and whatnot. And she's quite good in this. And I mean, everyone is, just what you guys said, with what the roles call upon them to do. I always thought Lucy Liu, I think we talked about this in our Charlie's Angels episode, I disagree with Bill Murray. I always thought she should have been, you know, maybe something a little bit bigger. I mean, she's rich. She's doing all right for herself. But like, I understand she made some real stinkers that kind of derailed some momentum. But I like her. She's good in this. I like her character and I like her attitude. And I like her performance of it. Vivica A. Fox is always awesome. And
Daryl Hannah, like, as I was watching her, I'm like, fuck, she was in Splash, wasn't she? You know, like, and to just, I'm not sure how often in her career Daryl Hannah was allowed to be like that malevolent, domineering presence that she does so well here.
I know I've seen other movies with her, but I always, because I haven't even seen Splash, I always think of Blade Runner. And I mean, she's a villain in Blade Runner, but she's not this type of villain. So it was, it was still, I was like, oh, it's Daryl Hannah. But anyway, Uma Thurman, I was impressed by how hard, I mean, I knew that she was committed to this role, right? And she gets kind of a co-creator role in the either the opening credits or at the end. You know, it's like The Bride, created by QT and I guess UT.
It said in the DVD commentary, the idea for the movie, they started toying around with it when they were making Pulp Fiction.
Okay, well, that took a while. But she seems so committed, and I it's not that I've forgotten, but it's just so nice to re-experience it because she has such conviction, even when delivering the most ridiculous lines. Mm. And I don't think, I agree, Chaz, that I think that everybody's, you know, they brought their A game and I think that they're all having fun and they know exactly what movie they're in. But I don't think that everybody gets to pull off the lines the way that Uma Thurman does. When she, early on, when she goes...
To get even, Steven, I would have to kill you.
For us to be even Steven, yeah. I was like, wow. That could have derailed the movie and it didn't. It's not great, but you know, she, because of what she does before, what she does after, I think that it works. Some of the other actors, they don't get, you know, maybe because they have less screen time or maybe they're just, they didn't come up with the character. I don't know. But I guess this is to say that I love the Uma Thurman performance. That's probably my favorite thing, having rewatched it just now. I think that that's my highlight. I think that Uma Thurman is like a force of nature here. And she's like, she believes in this character and this story so much. On the other side, what's new to me on this rewatch is that a little bit like I alluded to in Contrarian's Corner, I'm not used to saying, man, that this Tarantino dialogue is not great. But that's what I'm saying here. Because there's a lot of like cringe lines. And yes, Alex, when they said Silly Rabbits, Tricks Are For Kids, I almost turned away from the screen because it was just so bad. Chaz, where do you land on the dialogue here?
I mean, the standout moments from the film for me are actually the ones that are most quote-unquote Tarantino-esque. Like, I love the knife fight being interrupted by the little girl and then Vivica Fox and Uma Thurman's dialogue scene. Like, you could just feel the tension in it and there was great character work. And I also really loved the Hanzo Hattori pretending to be a sushi.
Mm-hmm.
Like yes, it takes the pace out of the film, but it's deliberate and it's fun and hilarious. And the relationship between him and his like little henchman who gets the tea and the sake is hilarious, and it just goes on for so long. Like, it's indulgent, but it works for me way more than the Crazy 88 fight or anything like that. So I don't think the dialogue in Kill Bill rivals anything of his other films. And I think from memory, like, I came out, and again, I'm really interested to do the next recording of this because I ended up liking Kill Bill Volume 1 more with this rewatch than I remember enjoying it coming out of cinema. And I remember coming out of cinemas enjoying Volume 2 more than Volume 1. And I wonder if that's going to swap.
That'll be a shame if it flips.
With this rewatch. But I just remember Volume 2 being much more Tarantino-esque, like much longer dialogue-driven scenes.
That's what I remember too. I think that, yes, I'm with you, that I appreciate the quiet moments too. That's probably the highlight of the movie for me, the Okinawa sequence, because that guy's a great actor. Sonny Chiba's great. It's almost, and maybe it's just because the dialogue is almost secondary in the sense because it's a character that's speaking English as a second language. And then, you know, when he's speaking Japanese, we're reading the subtitles. So for me, experiencing that performance, it was just about like his eyes, his facial expression, you can feel the sorrow and the guilt and just all these conflicting emotions when he finds out what's going on, what's really going on. And that, I think that's where Kill Bill Volume 1 at least has its soul. Like, I can't tell you that I really connect to the revenge story other than a very primal level of, oh, you know, they did it wrong and I want her to get revenge. But the human feeling of it, more so, and this might sound harsh, I mean, it's not meant to, but, you know, more so than her waking up and realizing that her kid is gone, is just more of a, this old man who walked away from this life of violence and suddenly this foreigner comes in and drags him in just for like a couple scenes of him breaking his vow. He said he wasn't going to deal violence anymore. And well, here he is forging a new sword for her and all that stuff. I think that that's really, really good stuff. I really hope that Volume 2 has those moments also. Or, you know, the worst case scenario is that Volume 2 goes the other way and it's just a whole bunch of, it's the other type of Tarantino jerk-off, right? Where he's just like in love with his dialogue. And, you know, that's why I don't like Hateful Eight. I think Hateful Eight errs the other way. It's like, it's just, I mean, Tarantino wrote it as a play, so I guess that makes sense. But it's just like, you know, there's so much talking. But yeah, Hattori Hanzo, do you have at least nice words for Hattori Hanzo in Okinawa, Alex?
Yeah, man. I mean, it's a good scene, and that's honestly probably, aside from her Oscar clip, which is just, you know, that's really good acting. I think the scene I like Uma Thurman the most in is that one, because I think her and Sonny Chiba like play off each other so well. And she's really likable in the beginning of that scene and seems so like head in the clouds and so unaware. And, you know, he's not trying to exploit that, but, you know, he's just like, oh, I just run this sushi shop now, you know, and, you know, woe's me. And then when she like lets him know that she knows, his like transformation's really good. There's good stuff in this movie. It's just like, when put together, I hate saying this because Tarantino he's Tarantino, but like, I'm just as soon watch like an old Bruce Lee movie or something instead of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's one of those things where one of the reasons that we differ so much. I don't know, Chaz, how familiar are you with that genre? I am not. Like, I'm aware of it. If you tell me who Bruce Lee is and what kind of movies he made, like I have a pretty good idea to where I can tell that this movie is a riff on that. But I'm not a devotee, so I can't tell you what Alex just said because I haven't seen any of them.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you that it's better the other way around.
No, like I went through a phase of going through all the amazing, really grindhouse martial arts films that are on Netflix over here in Australia. And there's like a particularly good run of Indonesian ones and Korean ones. And they are a lot like this, where it's like the simplest, thinnest of plots for an excuse of just the most epic fights. But the fights are just so much better in those movies than this. And that's, you know, like, Tarantino's having more fun, but for someone who's like paying homage to those movies and like trying to do the spectacle, I was serious. Like when I watched that knife fight in the opening chapter, I was surprised by like, oh, I remember this being better. And for someone who loves cinema so much and loved these movies so much, I kind of like, I think Tarantino could have done better with this fight. Like the choreography was amazing, but it was how it was shot that I was just like, this does not feel very impressive. And maybe it's just, you know, I feel the same way about Sam Peckinpah westerns. I'm like, everyone, all these like old film buffs rave about those films, and I go and watch them, and I'm like, this isn't that great. And I think he broke all these molds at the time. And it's not to say Tarantino was breaking molds, but he was trying to bring something to Western audiences. And then I guess in that he's successful because there aren't that many Western films like Kill Bill. I mean, there are now more, you know, like you guys referenced John Wick. Like that's where we are now. That's our minimum expectations of an action movie. Kinpatsu no senshi, yukinasai.
Domo.
This was around the time of was Crouching Tiger 99 and Hero, that Jet Li movie too. I remember are like the ones that, at least for us, Chaz in America, I remember those momentarily. Well, I mean, Crouching Tiger, I think that was nominated for Best Picture, so it temporarily swelled interest in that type of thing, those types of films, I should say. And when this came out, I think in a lot of the average movie going public's mind, at least domestically here, it was just kind of an extension of that, but from the guy who made Pulp Fiction. So,
and Bourne came out the year before as well.
Yes. I think truthfully, most people that went to see this movie got what they were expecting from it. And by most people, I mean folks who aren't as in the weeds as we are with the source material and the creator and whatnot. I think if you heard Kung Fu movie directed by Quentin Tarantino, this pretty much fits the bill.
Yeah.
Well, I think it fits the bill more now. I think that back in 2003, we were, at least I was, unsure about if it was something that would work. Like if you told me today, I'll be like, yeah, of course it works. But that's because, you know, I think his body of work is such that I can infer what, almost like what any movie that he decides to make, like what it's going to be like, right? Like even if you tell me, you know, he's going to do his Star Trek movie, I have a pretty good idea of what that's going to be like. He probably still surprised me anyway, but it, you know, back then we had three movies and one of them was wildly different from the other two. So we didn't, I mean, I don't remember knowing anything about Kill Bill when it came out. You know, I don't even know if they were selling it as this is going to be Quentin Tarantino's action movie. I like the way it's shot. I am a lot less invested, I guess, in the action genre. So it, I think maybe it's a little easier to impress me. I like the cuts. And maybe it's also because in my memory, that fight scene in the kitchen is in the trailer. And it's timed to the music in the trailer. So it's like extra punchy, you know, like when she's defending herself. She's defending herself with the whatever, the pan, and she has a knife. And it's like, this is cool. What's happening?
Yeah.
So I hadn't seen the fight against the Crazy 88 in forever. So I had forgotten how arbitrary it is, almost like, you know, the black and white versus color. You know, I mean, he'll have her like blink and now you're in color, but there's no reason behind it. Like, you know, that we know the reason. It's like, oh, so the blood is not as, you know, doesn't get him, I guess it would be an X rating, but
NC-17.
Yeah. But I mean, it didn't distract me. It distracted me in the way that I was thinking about it, but I think that it flows really well. I really like when it goes to silhouettes towards the end of the fight, you know, and it's just her in silhouettes fighting all these
that
people.
That makes one of us.
Really? You didn't like the silhouette shot?
Nah, man, I was done by that point. I really like the tranquility of the fight in the garden where you're just hearing that the fountain.
The bamboo,
yes, that will fill up and then tip over and fill up and tip over. I like that. And for the ride you're on with that movie, yeah, of course she's going to get the top of her head cut off and nothing else. Like, that's what's going to happen.
Well, what I like there is just the when Lucy Lewis starts being very condescending, and then halfway through the fight, she acknowledges that Uma Thurman is a better fighter than she gave her credit for, and she kind of walks back. She apologizes, half apologizes for being disrespectful. I was like, all right, that's a nice little bit of character. Did not care for the spanking, though. I was not getting Kutcher's corner. I think that took me out of the movie. Chaz, did you? Can you justify it?
I enjoyed the spanking very much because, like, it's a returning motif for the character that she is not so bloodthirsty that she's cruel. Like, the opening scene sets that. Like, she lays out, if I was really out for the kind of revenge to get even, I would kill your child, I would kill your husband, but no, I just want you. And so, like, confronting that poor little boy, you know, I'm like, yes, this is the right moment for that.
See, I don't mind that she spares his life. I just mind that she spanks him.
Well, there had to be something to stop him. I mean, maybe it's because I have children and I wish I could beat them with a samurai sword and I'm not allowed to anymore.
This is what you get for fucking around with Yakuzas! Go home to your mother!
Yeah, there's always something in a Tarantino movie that there's a momentary, like, huh? That has, like, no peer or parallel anywhere else in the movie. Right now, I'm thinking of the part in Pulp Fiction where Uma Thurman goes, come on, don't be a... And then with her fingers draws the outline of a square, and a square is drawn on the screen. There's nothing else in that movie like that. And so... Yeah, it comes with the territory, as they say with Tarantino here. Julio, you mentioned fighters and fighting. This is obviously a very fighting-heavy movie. As with almost anything with a relevance from a pop culture perspective as this, there are some wrestling tie-ins to acknowledge.
I was going to say, like, were there any wrestlers in this that I missed?
Yeah, you weren't familiar with Uma Thurman's run as the WWE champion? Homicide, who was the former Ring of Honor champion and an independent wrestling standout, his entrance theme, it always started with the and then this flashing red light would go off before he came out. So there was that. There was some skit once done. I can't remember the setup for it. I just remember that basically it was Kairi Sane, who's a Japanese women's wrestler. It was very, like, campy acted out, but the punchline was she was like the last person for this woman to get to the final boss, and the she ended up hitting her in the head with a barbed wire baseball bat, and it was shot like that scene within Kill Bill. And then lastly, Becky Lynch, famously, the shows they do in Saudi Arabia twice a year, the women have to wear full body suits as to not show skin or give men thoughts of lust, which is really the punchline of that is these women that are really built wear these skin tight body suits that are way more like damn than the stuff they wear on television every week in America. So, but Becky Lynch kind of turned that on its head and wore the yellow jumpsuit from this. And she came out with like a Kill Bill style presence. So I think a younger generation will associate that yellow jumpsuit with this movie over, Bruce Lee and Game of Death, excuse me. So from an imagery perspective, maybe one of his most memorable characters in The Bride.
I'll say this is honing down on my final evaluation. What I take away from this movie is that he did Reservoir Dogs, he did Pulp Fiction. It made him an acclaimed director. I think that when we talked about Jackie Brown, Alex, a long time ago, I referenced this, but you know, he set out with Jackie Brown, he set out to prove that he could make an adult movie, like a serious movie, a mature filmmaker movie.
A porno.
Yeah, not a porno, but a mature, what is that a mature Tarantino like? Oh, it's like Jackie Brown. And you don't have to wait 20 years to see me make it. I'm making it right now. And then it almost feels like Kill Bill Volume 1 is his response to that, you know, to his own movement. It was like, okay, I showed you what it's like when I'm mature. Now I'm going to show you what I'm like when I'm at my most, you know, playful and most
unhinged.
Unhinged, maybe. I think he's always a little bit unhinged, but you know, this is just him not giving a fuck. And then I don't think that this is where he's up his own ass, Chaz. I think that he's up his own ass with Grindhouse. That's where he, we could have lost him. But thankfully, that movie didn't make any money. So maybe that forced him to reassess, and then he went on to the second half of his career, I guess, where he just got a little more serious. I had never really thought about the fact that this really stands out in a way, like this Volume 2 and Death Proof are this sort of wild Tarantino-like style over substance. I think that usually he's like style and substance hand in hand. And, you know, those three are less so. Maybe Volume 2 is a little more serious. Like you've been saying, I'm very curious to revisit it. But I came from this thinking that I still like it a lot. Definitely like it more than you, Alex. But I don't like it as much as I did back in 2003 when it just blew me away. And I couldn't wait, you know, to see what was going to happen next in the story and what was going to happen next with this filmmaker. I know the answer to both now. And he went on to make movies that I like much better. And the story is, you know, the story is what it is.
So, it's interesting seeing it in the context of his career, because it's like seeing it as Tarantino's fourth film is very different when it comes out as seeing it after his nine movies.
Yes, yeah. Because if he hadn't gone on to make movies like Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, you know, the heavy movies, then maybe this wouldn't stand out as much. You know, if he had done more Kill Bills, then maybe I would be angrier at this movie. Like, this is where he lost his way. So are you guys ready to rate this thing? Alex, let's start with you. Let's start at the bottom.
Well, there's more to it than I remembered. So that's a positive. It's not in my collection. I don't know if I'll ever own it. I mean, you know, 20 years from now, they might do the definitive Tarantino set, which will be on, I don't fucking know, virtual reality or something. But see. I'm going to give it a C. It's there in the middle. It's not bad. I'm going to joke about it like it's bad, but it's not a bad movie.
A good time, right?
I was having a good time until we got to like the animated sequence derailed it, but then got it back with the bar scene and the sushi bar. And I mean, of course, I'm going to pop like when blood's spurting out like a fountain. I'm like, you know, it's very complimentary of this, like from a filmmaking perspective. It's just I've seen it done better and I've seen the creator do much better. So that's kind of always why it just kind of falls on its side for me. So a C, but I did come away with some things that I hadn't had before that I will retain to speak positively of in the future.
Let's do a contrarian sandwich. So that means that Chaz is in the middle.
Is it? I want to reference this director who I've seen a few of his films and I really like it, but I'm probably going to absolutely butcher his name. But is it Takashi Miike?
Yes.
Who did 13 Assassins.
Nice.
And Ichi the Killer. And God, he did this he makes a bajillion movies, but he did this like really melodramatic movie that I really loved as well. But I reckon his version of this would have been absolutely amazing. But in giving my rating, just so that everyone knows, like I get paid out a lot by my friends for giving everything 4 stars. Like everything I watch is 4 stars. So this is like 3 stars is for me. This movie got made and I don't actively dislike it. So I'm pretty generous in my... Because I think that's a massive success. If this movie got made and I don't actively dislike it, 3 stars, then 4 stars is it's good. And I think this is a 3.5.
Oh, wow. That's lower than I expected. But I was also going to say that style of rating movies or that perspective, that's your inner dad, like just coming out. I know of Takashi Miike. I don't think that I've actually watched any of his movies. But you are right that this is the white vanilla version of it, of that type of movie. But you know what? When I'm sitting down to watch it, I don't care. And most of the credit goes to Uma Thurman. And you know, Tarantino's doing great too. But it's, yeah, if I start comparing it to what like the real version of this movie would be, then I think that we're all in trouble. But as something that I hadn't watched in a while, and I sat down and it kept me interested, even when it was making me cringe every now and then. I mean, it's good. I know 3, I would have given it 5 stars because I was just in love with it. Wow. At 4 stars. I'm at 4 stars right now.
That woman deserves her revenge. We deserve to die.
So I did want to call out that I didn't go through my usuals. This movie came out on October 10th of 2003, which was almost 9 years to the day of the release of Pulp Fiction. I'm going to save the box office discussion for the second half because then we can compare it to kind of the rest of his career and where these sit as far as a financial success goes. So we'll save that for then. But until then... Julio, we know the baby's still alive. We're gonna have to wait a little while to meet it, but
Sophie teases that the baby's alive. We are teasing the box office and also the big David Carradine return, or you know, the thing that Kill Bill 1 wasn't, you know, that's Kill Bill 2, that's where he comes into play as an actor. And I think that that'll be an interesting thing to talk about next episode, along with the idea of what Chaz said, the whole bloody affair. I mean, that is a cut that exists. It doesn't seem to be very available, but it was supposed to be the original idea. So, you know, when he came up with it, it was supposed to be all one movie. And I've never been able to see it. It's always confused me because having watched Volume 1 and 2 separately, they feel like separate movies. I don't know how you mesh them together to where it makes sense. But maybe it will make sense after we... you know, revisit them for next episode. So that's coming up next. It's episode 200, Kill Bill Volume 2. Chaz will be here with us. Alex, hopefully we'll have a better time with with a movie that's slightly more Tarantino-esque, I guess.
We'll see. And we'll also give you the opportunity to do this in the next episode, Chaz, but go ahead and let people know where they can find you and what you have to offer in the realm of podcasting.
Thank you very much. Like I've already plugged it, but it's really only for people who are story or screenplay aficionados. Like we just get too in the weeds. Our podcast, if you like the idea, if you listen to famous screenwriting podcasts that only take an hour and you're like, I wanted more, then we're the podcast for you.
Endorsed by Quentin Tarantino. After a fashion.
Yes. Yeah. Listen to by Quentin Tarantino, certainly. But the other thing, so my podcasting co-host, Stu Willis, and our most frequent guest Mel Killingsworth, they have now broadened out past Draft Zero to Shot Zero, which can be found on, I think, all the social medias, definitely on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, which is just them doing a wonderful lot of short posts, breakdowns of what makes great shots in different movies work. And Stu and Mel have very different personal preferences and tastes as both consumers of media and as artists themselves, as writer directors. So it's a really good project that I have very little to do other than I think my money in some way pays for it.
It is. I can speak to the quality of Shot Zero. And I follow him on Instagram, and Mel is one of my favorite reviewers on Letterboxd. So and Stu, of course, I've known for a while. So yes, I recommend Shot Zero. I recommend Draft Zero. They not only get the Quentin Tarantino endorsement, they get the Contrarians endorsement, as they have, you know, every time Chaz is around here.
You guys should have Mel on the show. She would be great.
I'm sure she would. I am intimidated, though, because I mean, the advantage, Chaz, and even Stu, you know, I've met you in person. We're buddies. Like, Mel and yeah. I, like, we're friendly online, and we've had a good time. We did a Twitter thread watching Gladiator and Starship Troopers at the same time. So, you know, I think that we get along well. But she is so smart, or at least she comes across as so smart. I fear that both Alex and I would be outmatched. And
this swiftly turned from a compliment to Mel to an insult to me. Like, I'm dumb enough to be on your podcast is what I'm getting from that.
No, you're my buddy,
that.
So I don't find my buddies intimidating. That's what I mean. I think, I need to have a few beers with Mel so I can feel comfortable having her over.
All right. We'll have to make that happen.
All right. Let's get out of here, Alex.
Let's do it. Welcome to our end credits.
Or as we usually call them, our perennial plugs.
We start off by giving thanks to the Festive Years, who provide our opening and closing tracks. They kick us off with Last Stand and take us home with Summer of 99. Be sure to head over to thefestiveyears.com for any and all Festive Years needs.
Our friend and fellow podcaster, Hans Rothgeiser, is the man behind our logo and all the art you see related to our show. Reach out to him and let him know how much you like that little tomato. His email address is mildemonios@hotmail.com and his website is mildemonios.pe. That's mildemonios. You can also check out his podcast, Nación Combi, about Peruvian current affairs, and Marginal, about economy. Hans, thank you for all your support.
For those interested in the regularly absurd world of professional wrestling, Joe and the boys over at latenightgrin.com have you covered. Tell them the Contrarian sent you.
And we'd like to close with special thanks to our social media team of Zoe Perez and Corey Ari. Each of the social media accounts we mentioned in the introduction look as good as they do because of their work.
So that'll do it for this episode of The Contrarians, where we're right and you're wrong, and we will catch you next time. How much money he makes a year.